case number 2329, Mark Lloyd versus Crawford and Gamble Disabilities et al. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Ayers.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Ms. Mitchell. I would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
I would like to begin, just if I might, by going through some of the primary arguments that we have raised as to why the decision of the Procter & Gamble Disability Plan was arbitrary and capricious, why the plan acted arbitrarily and capriciously in denying both of Mr. Lloyd's two claims, which are before you. Several arguments are particularly noteworthy here. One is that Mr. Lloyd suffered from a very rare condition called chronic intestinal pseudoobstruction, or SIPO, and the plan had two gastroenterologists review the claims, both of the claims, but neither of those gastroenterologists specialized or said they had any expertise in treatment or diagnosis or the functional effects of that particular condition. In fact, the first reviewer, Dr. Sheth, actually suggested to the plan that they seek an opinion from someone who was familiar with this particular condition, and the plan did not do so. I see that as a major shortcoming in the plan's analysis to begin with.
So aren't there only, according to something I read in the record, there are only a handful of specialists in the country? So, and one of them is on the plaintiff's side already, so now like we're down to four. So is it the plan's responsibility? Is it your claim that the plan acts arbitrarily and capriciously if they don't contact one of those other four doctors?
That is, Your Honor, that is one of our arguments, which is that at least they had an obligation to try to find someone familiar with this condition, and there's no indication in the record that they made any attempt to do so.
It's not that they're not familiar with the condition, right? Dr. Sheth certainly indicates in his report a familiarity with SIPO, or SIPO, I've been calling it SIPO, maybe I'm wrong, SIPO, that, I mean, he indicates some familiarity because he quotes literature and he says this is ordinarily how it's diagnosed and this is ordinarily the sort of presentation we would see. So it's not that he's unfamiliar with the condition.
Not totally unfamiliar, no.
Right.
But he did say to the plan that it might be appropriate to seek an opinion from someone more familiar with the condition than I am. And that's something they did not do or did not attempt to do.
Right.
Beyond that, Your Honor, the there are several other key problems in the plan's consideration of Mr. Lloyd's claims. And this has to do primarily with the second review that was done by Dr. Strahoten. And one of the things that Dr. Strahoten said, one of the main things that she said, was that she thought that Mr. Lloyd might be capable of working, but he would have to be at home, this being a GI issue, that he would have to be home, he would have to have less responsibilities, there would have to be a lot of flexibility in terms of bathroom breaks, proximity to a bathroom, and leniency, that was her word, in terms of periods of time when he would be basically bedridden due to his condition. Those very accommodations had been attempted previously in connection with Mr. Lloyd's problems a couple of years before that, where Procter & Gamble allowed him to try to work from home with those very accommodations.
Wasn't there some suggestion, I remember, that he had been getting better because he had been treated with another drug? I mean, couldn't, even if they had been tried before, wasn't it a different circumstance?
There was a suggestion made by Dr. Strahoten, the reviewer that I'm referring to, Your Honor, in the record, that she felt that there was some indication of improvement in Mr. Lloyd's status once he had been put on a different medication called domperidone, in October of 2016. However, she indicated in her report to the plan that, and this is tied into that particular observation, that Mr. Lloyd had been totally disabled, in her opinion, until that time, until he had been put on that medication, domperidone, in October of 2016, and then partially disabled after that date. The point there is that, there's a couple points there. When she said totally disabled and then became partially disabled, she was responding to a question put to her by the P&G Disability Committee about whether Mr. Lloyd's condition had changed at some point in time from, for example, from totally disabled to partially or from partially to totally, the plan having two different types of disability benefits, total and partial, obviously. And she was asked to address that question, and she said, yes, he was totally disabled up until the point where he was put on this medication, and then from my, according to her, there was enough improvement in his status that he became partially disabled at that point.
I mean, it seemed like a kind of a throwaway line. I mean, I don't know that she did a thorough evaluation enough to say that he was definitely totally disabled 2 years ago or 3 years ago. I mean, there's a line in her report. I got you on that. Right. I guess I wouldn't read too much into it. But
respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree. I mean, she was asked to state that specific opinion.
But even if so, doesn't that sort of give away the argument you were making now? So even if what she said, if we can debate how much significance it has, right, was that, okay, before he was put on the domperidone, he was totally disabled. Well, then before he was on that, the work from home probably wouldn't work because he probably couldn't work at all. Right. But then once he's on the domperidone, now he's not totally disabled. So something would have changed, right? So doesn't that undercut, even if we credit the first argument, doesn't it undercut the second?
It does in that sense, but there's another aspect to this that I'd like to bring up in just a second. But before I leave the point is that the plan had Dr. Strahovin's opinion and didn't do anything with it. They simply ignored her opinion and determined without any real meaningful analysis, as far as I can tell, that he was never disabled, whether partially or totally. That's an abuse of discretion, and it's completely unreasonable. The other aspect then, and this is one of the other key arguments in this case, is that Dr. Strahovin was not given the definitions of total disability versus partial disability in the plan. There's no indication in the record she had those definitions.
Did any of the doctors have those definitions?
I am not sure whether Dr. Sheth had those definitions or not. I would have to look. But the point I was going to get to, Judge Larson, was that if you look at the plan's definition of total disability, which is talked about a lot in the briefs, it's a very unusual definition. It's on the surface a very strict definition. You have to have a medical condition that is generally felt to be disabling by the medical community. That's the first prong. And the second prong being usually results in confinement essentially to one's own home. We feel that we presented lots of evidence, not just from Dr. Kirby, the attending specialist, but from Mr. Lloyd's other four physicians who also provided reports, that was the case. He was essentially housebound. And I read Dr. Strahovin's report for the proposition that she agreed with that. While she said he may be able to work or had some work capability after he was started on this medication, she still said that it would have to be from home. And if you strictly construe the definition that the plan uses, he meets both prongs of that definition, the second prong being he has to be home. So
you're saying that somebody would be, even if I could do my regular job duties and I had to be at home to do it, I would still be totally disabled.
Yes, Your Honor. I know that sounds counterintuitive, and I acknowledge that in my brief, but this is the plan's definition. That's what the definition says.
I mean, a lot of people have been working from home.
I'm well aware.
They're not all.
I'm well aware, and most plans, and you're probably aware of this, most long-term disability plans out there don't couch total disability in this fashion. They tie it directly to workability. This plan does not do that.
Well, so that's interesting because the partial disability definition does, right?
Yes.
It says you cannot perform your regular duties of your job, but can perform other roles at the same site or other jobs outside the company.
Right.
I'm curious, does that mean if I could do my job, regular duties, at home, would I wouldn't be partially disabled then? I wouldn't be doing another job. I would be doing my normal job, but I would have to do it at home or with accommodations. Would I be partially disabled?
I think you want me to say yes, that you could be partially.
I don't know the answer. I'm curious.
You would not be partially disabled, but under the terms of the policy, you'd be totally disabled.
Because I'm confined to home.
Yes.
Can I ask you one more question? Is that all right?
Sure.
So what is our standard of review with respect to reading the contract? So right now we're just talking about contract interpretation. I understand the plan has discretion, so we have to give them arbitrary and capricious review as to both facts and law, I think. Law meaning what the contract says. But is this like a Chevron sort of analysis where we first have to decide if the contract is ambiguous, and then only if we decide it's ambiguous, then we move on to reasonable interpretation? Or instead, does the law say, if they've given any reasonable interpretation to the plan, we have to go with that?
I have to confess that I'm not familiar with the Chevron case that you just mentioned. My position would be that you just simply look to the letter of the definition. It's a central part of the plan, obviously. The most important provision.
So you said basically de novo review of the contract language? I'm sure you'd like us to do that.
Yes, that would be fine with.
But I'm wondering whether that's what our cases permit.
Yeah, I don't know if your cases permit that, honestly. I didn't brief that particular issue.
All right, Mr.
I was just going by the strict.
Thank you.
Rule.
Thank you for your argument. You'll have your 4 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jennifer Mitchell. On behalf of the PNG Long-Term Disability Allowance Plan, the Disability Benefit Plan, and the committee, also formerly known as the Benefit Plan Trustees, which we've referred to as committee, and just collectively I'll refer to them all as the plan for purposes of our argument today. We respectfully request that the court affirm the district court's decision as to the denial of benefits claims here today that were brought pursuant to.
You're not challenging the district court's finding that he was partially that it was arbitrary and capricious that he was partially disabled or whatever.
We didn't challenge that finding. When we read the whole decision, we decided that we would not appeal or cross appeal on that issue.
It's a little strange, though, that he would be partially disabled at the point where he was supposedly getting better and is not disabled at all at time one, I mean, the first claim. I mean, what do we do with that then? So we have the judge saying, okay, well, I think he was partially disabled. I mean, he's not really that different, is he, in that time period, his physical condition?
I think you make a valid point, but I think if you look back at the progression of what the administrative record contains, which is what we have to look at each discrete point in time, and what the district court looked at. It looked at what it had available to it at the time.
They're separate claims, too.
They're separate claims.
Yeah, and there's evaluation of claim one, and there's evaluation of claim two, and there's different evidence, there's different documentation. I mean, yeah, there's different results, but there's different documents.
Exactly, and there are different time periods disability involved as well.
So Judge McFarland, so what's the difference? It's the Strahoten report? I mean, in other words, that's not available the first time, right? And there's the second Sheth report that wasn't available the first time. And so he says the committee acted arbitrarily and capriciously in light of this new evidence. Is that?
I think he looked at her opinion and said, if you take a look at what she said here, she said he's partially disabled. And the plan should have taken that and given him that discrete benefit period from January 16th of 2017 to January 28th, which was when his employment terminated, and said, if I look at what she said and I look at the 12 pages where she's evaluated everything forwards and backwards, and she's looked at all of the reviews, she's looked at everything that's been in the administrative record, and she's found that there was a period in which that she would say at that time he was partially disabled. For the plan then to say, based on our interpretation of the records and her report and the language of the partial disability, that he was not, that the court didn't agree. We haven't challenged that decision by the court. Because we decided to accept the district court's ruling. We believe in all other respects, where it didn't find anything arbitrary and capricious about the plan's decision-making, it was entirely correct. I think that there are grounds to support the decision on the partial disability, but we chose not to appeal that issue.
Can you answer my question about the standard of review with respect to interpreting the contract? So, he makes a good point. Your friend on the other side makes a good point that, you know, the partial disability refers to ability to do the job. The total disability doesn't really refer to functional capacity at all. What's our standard of review with respect to just interpreting this contract? Normally we would do that de novo. I understand you have the authority to interpret, and so you get arbitrary and capricious review. But how does that affect our contract interpretation?
I would say that the court also needs to look at it from an arbitrary and capricious standard in terms of applying the plan terms and look at how the plan applied the terms. So in terms of what your standard of review would be, yes, you're de novo reviewing, but you're still applying that highly deferential, arbitrary, and capricious standard of review.
So I don't understand how to do de novo with deference. So I don't, please help me.
So my understanding, and based on the case law, is that you sit here today and you can take a look anew. You don't have to rely on the district court, but you do have to still give deference to the plan's decision-making and how it ruled. And unless you find that its decision-making was arbitrary and capricious, you have to.
That includes their interpretation of the contract?
We would say yes.
And what's your best case for that proposition?
So there's a long list of cases in which this exact same language has been interpreted by the various courts, the Southern District, this court, in Wilkins. And we also cited to a number of other cases throughout the country where this exact plan language has been applied and given the deference both at the district and appellate court level.
Right, so those cases stand for the proposition that here's how other district courts have cashed out this language. But what I want to know is, what's a case that stands for the proposition that we defer to any reasonable reading of this contract language you can come up with? Whereas, like, if you were an administrative agency, we would first ask, is the statute plain, right? Is there any ambiguity in the statute? If no, we just decide what it means. If yes, then we defer to the agency. But I'm asking, is it like that? Or do we just go straight to step two and say, well, if we could kind of come up with something out of this language, this contract language alone, that supports the plan, then we have to defer immediately. We skip what I would call Chevron step one.
So I don't know that I can cite to you a case right here that would help you, but I think if you take a look back at the construct of ERISA in general and the reason why it was established, it was so that the plan had, the plans would have control over how the administration is completed from soup to nuts. So the plan has the ability and the discretion, and it's granted that discretion to establish its terms of its plan and acknowledge that the definition of total disability here is very different than it is in other contexts, in the Social Security disability context and in other contexts. But if you go back to the whole regime of ERISA and the confining the court to the administrative record, and then also taking a look at how the courts are to give deference, it really is to say the plan has the ability to make its terms, the plan has the ability to perform reviews, the plan has the ability to make decisions, and unless it is arbitrary and capricious, the plan doesn't necessarily even have to be right in order to be upheld.
But it can't be that you can give any meaning to the word. So what if the plan just said, you are totally disabled if you are blind, and somebody comes in and they have a diagnosis that says, well, I'm blind, and you say, oh no, when we say blind, what we mean is you can't hear. We would say, well, no, that's not what, blind doesn't mean I can't hear, blind means I can't see, and wouldn't we have to say that's arbitrary and capricious?
I think in the instance where someone was going to define blind as deaf or deaf as blind, that's different than, and that's not what we've got here.
Isn't that the check, I mean, that ERISA has? I mean, it's a very deferential standard, but there still is a check of arbitrary and capricious. Right. And that would include an interpretation of the plan, application of the plan. That's why it's so hard for plaintiffs to win these ERISA cases, and how we don't see them win very often because of arbitrary and capricious. But it still is a check.
And it is. It is. And it's to say that if there's no reasoned basis for the decision, the court can step
that's
in.
That's kind of what arbitrary and capricious means, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
But do you concede that your total disability definition doesn't actually tie itself to functional capacity?
Well, it does in the sense that it ties itself to objective medical evidence, which was a big piece of it, too. And I would sort of consider those to be on the same plane, because if you're looking at the functional capacity, that would be usually you're getting that assessment. It would be an objective medical finding of sorts. So the plan does tie it to requiring objective medical evidence. And that's one of the things I think that filters throughout the entire administrative record is the lack of that objective medical evidence to establish the total disability under the terms of the plan. So again, I think that Mr. Lloyds argued that Social Security granted him disability benefits, compassionate allowance, and other things, that he had some other benefits that he, I think, also received from another policy, but those were different plan provisions. Under the Procter & Gamble Disability Benefit Plan provision, the requirements are very specific. They require objective medical evidence. They also require, as was stated, the person is typically confined to their home or to a hospital. And so if you take a look at what the record shows and the improvement made with Dom Perignon, and that Mr. Lloyd hadn't been to the hospital in quite a while. Yes.
Strahoten, doesn't she essentially say he's got to work from home?
She does. Mean,
that's essentially confinement, isn't it?
She suggests he's not totally disabled because the plan could provide accommodations to him so that he could work with certain, like you said, from home concessions or accommodations to him to allow him to do that. He also was a computer, he worked on the computer. He was computer systems, that was his job. So much of what he did, again, functionally, for his work was computer related. And so I think that the plan is taking that into consideration as well.
Why doesn't that mean that he's, I'm confused then, so he has to be at home in order to manage his medical condition, doesn't he? I understand he can do his job at home, but this was my question about, if I can do my job at home, am I totally disabled? And I don't see anything in definition that says if you can do your regular job at home, you're not totally disabled. It just says if you have a medical condition that requires you to be at home, you're totally disabled. And that's exactly what she said. I mean, I don't know what other evidence you would need.
To follow on that, and I think you'll be able to answer us both, like, what if you got COVID and so you had to be from home? Let's say you got COVID and a new variant and it lasts for years and years. You're totally contagious. But you'd work, you just can't leave your home. Are you totally disabled under your plan? And why not?
Well, I mean, I think you raise a valid point. And if you look at the definition, it says it means a mental or physical condition resulting from an illness or injury that is generally considered totally disabling by the medical profession. And that's one point where we disagreed, that we had reviewers that said he wasn't totally disabled with respect to the SIPO diagnosis that he had, whereas his doctor said that he was, and for which the participant is receiving regular recognized treatment by a qualified medical professional. So those two prongs. And then it goes on to say total disability involves a condition of such severity as to require care in a hospital or restriction to the immediate confines of the home. It doesn't really just say work from home, really. It says restriction to the immediate confines of the home. So I think that's where it wasn't arbitrary and capricious for the plan to decide that he was not totally disabled, because the overwhelming evidence in the administrative record showed that he was not restricted to the immediate confines of his home. There were times when he had flare-ups where he had to stay closer to a restroom or perhaps couldn't get out of bed, but those were improving over time as well.
Saying this means essentially you've got to be bedridden or
hospitalized.
Confined or whatever it would be, and like just not functional at all.
Right. So with respect to COVID, some people don't have any symptoms. Some people are, some people have passed away. Some people are very, very sick for a period of time. I think that you couldn't say that every single one of those people would be totally disabled under this under this definition. I think that some of them would be and some of them would not be.
Mm-hmm. Because, and the same might be true with respect to SIPO, because I believe there's some testimony in here that it's like not one size fits all. It's sort not. Of, it might depend on the patient how bad it is.
I think that all of the reviewers, including Dr. Kirby, would agree with that there are varying levels of SIPO. Some people have to have their small intestines replaced, a transplant. I don't believe that's a situation that has occurred with Mr. Lloyd. Some do have more signs that are more objective. Here, I think part of the problem is that largely what the plaintiff below and here on appeal was relying on were his subjective, mostly subjective opinions of reports, his subjective experiences of what went along with this that led to that diagnosis. So again, there was a lack of that objective medical evidence. Dr. Strahoten did a very thorough evaluation and determined that there was no total disability under the plan for that time period. The prior reviewer, Dr. Sheff, didn't have access to all of this. He made a decision that was not arbitrary and capricious. And for those reasons, we would, and I'm out of time here, but we would ask the court to uphold the plan's decisions.
Thank you, Ms. Mitchell.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Ehlers, you have 4 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly to comment on some of the statements made by counsel and the positions taken. First of all, in terms of subjective versus objective, which is often a subject of debate in disability cases, you hear about subjective symptoms and objective findings and so forth. This condition, by its very name, it's pseudo-obstruction. It's not an organic obstruction in his bowel that's demonstrably, objectively verifiable, as it would be in some other type of situation where there's a physical obstruction in the bowel. That's the nature of this particular disease process. That's why it's named that. Yes, he has subjectively reported to his physicians what's been going on with him, but the point is that all of his physicians, treating physicians, have believed him, particularly Dr. Kirby, the expert, but also his primary care physician and a couple of other local physicians.
So there's nothing that would show up on a test? Is that your point?
Not in terms of a CAT scan or something like that.
Well, but any kind of test?
He had as I recall, and it's in the record, he did have a motility test done, which Dr. Kirby...
showed normal motility.
Dr. Kirby, arguably was read that way, but Dr. Kirby still thought that it was consistent with his condition.
Yeah.
Beyond that, you have, and back to the question of the plan's definition, respectfully, the plan, like has cited in its brief, a number of district court decisions from around the country, and touts the fact that universally the district courts have always upheld their plan. But none of those cases were like this case. In none of those cases did the plaintiff attempt to show that he actually met their definition of total disability. That is why this case is unique. We feel that he has established that both in terms of the first prong, and there was question about that, whether it's generally considered disabling by the medical community. We presented a lot of evidence that it was from other physicians, and they're in the record, Dr. Woe and Dr. Abel, outside consultants, were asked that question. And the plan has not provided any evidence that it's not generally considered disabling. It is. Social Security recognizes it as such by way of their compassionate allowance program. And then the second prong, to answer your question from before, Judge Larson, is there any wiggle room to this definition? I don't think there is. It says what it says in black and white, and I think they should be held to the letter of their definition. It's their plan. It's their definition, and they can't just throw that out when it suits them and say, we don't, you know, we can construe that however we want. It says what it says. And then finally, I would like to address a point made by Judge Nabetnell Banyan about the relief afforded by Judge McFarland. He only granted a very limited period of partial disability for about 4 weeks. That's just the backstory on that, is because the plan on a given application limits the individual to claiming disability back 4 weeks. And that's why Judge McFarland didn't feel he could go back beyond that. I would submit to you that he could have, and that this court could, in the exercise of its equity powers, given what Dr. Strahoten said, that he was disabled for a period of time up to the point and then partially disabled after that. And then the end date...
Thank you, Mr. Ehlers.
Okay. Thank you, Judge.